All right, welcome to Master Class. And I'm sorry, who was it that said she wanted to go first?
I was Anisha Betty.
Hi, Anisha. So you go ahead, and if you're ready, go ahead, take it away.
All right, thank you. Let me know when you can see my screen.
Yep, we can see it.
Yep, we can see it now.
Okay, can you see the one that says encryption types?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
So the presentation is going to be on encryption types. So what is encryption? Encryption is a type of concept developed to ensure that personal and private data is secured when we're doing day-to-day tasks, such as sending emails or going to the bank online. Encryption allows the desired software to scramble and manipulate data, such as credit card details, home addresses, emails, and financial information to ensure that malicious hackers can't abuse or misuse this information for their personal gains. While encryption is a concept that is very important and crucial to several organizations, it's a concept that's not very readily available or used. So the history of encryption. Encryption first came around the BC area when Julius Caesar used a subcipher to misplace and shift characters by three places to act as a simple and effective coding method. Soon after that, in 1553, Bellasio generated the first cipher to create a proper encryption key, which was used to give to a recipient to decode the message. Following that, in 1854, Wheatstone was the first individual to invent the Playfair cipher. The Playfair cipher was a disk graph sub-cipher that encrypts a message by breaking the text into different pairs of letters and then swapping the positions. Following that, in the 1970s, we had Hebern, who invented a machine that was electromechanical, in which it was able to encode a substitution table that rapidly changed every time a new character was tightened soon. And in 1918, we had Arthur, who invented the Enigma machine for commercial use that allowed the German military to send coded transmissions. Encryption and secret coding were a big concept that were used in World War II by several French, British, and American intelligence services. And this was used to send out messages to another without the other party being able to decipher those messages. Through the manual Roman encryption all the way to World War II encryption, modern-day computer-based encryption came in the early 1970s. The data encryption standard was first developed in 1973 by the National Bureau of Standards, or NBS, to protect any computer data that was used at the commercial level or at a large scale. The data encryption standard was a 64-bit cipher that had a 56-bit key and was the first public encryption that was developed by the US government after a long search for the DES key. So, data encryption standard. Data encryption standard, or DES, is also a encryption algorithm that was created in 1977. However, it was put away in 2002 after the advanced encryption standard was created and implemented. The cipher is used for this type of encryption, and the key bit that's used is 64 bits. However, only 56 bits are needed for it to be effective. The DES uses about 16 based on the structure, where each round is using a different key. The data encryption standard was initially created to make sure that the government systems were all secure and use the same standard of interconnectivity. However, the digital encryption standard was not shown to be effective and was inadequate because there were several vulnerabilities in the encryption method. It was prone to many brute forces, which showed that the encryption can be easily hacked and leaked. After the DES was proven to be adequate, another version called DDES was created. However, this algorithm was also proven not to be effective. The triple digital encryption standard was using the same methodologies of the DES, but the encryption was three times more. However, this encryption algorithm was proven to be vulnerable to brute force attacks as well. So Advanced Encryption Standard, or AES. The Advanced Encryption Standard is a cipher that is implemented in hardware and software to encrypt sensitive information. It's a symmetric cipher that protects the transfer of information online by providing security and speed as information is transferred between the networks. Advanced Encryption Standard uses the same key to encrypt and decrypt information. It also utilizes the substitution permutation network algorithms to encrypt data. Advanced Encryption Standard utilizes multiple key links, such as the 128-bit key length, the 192-bit key length, and the 256-bit key length. The AES allows for fast encryption, decryption time, and easy implementation during the workspace. This was originally developed in 1998 and replaced the DES. Originally, the data encryption had a length of 56 bits, and it wasn't enough to keep the encrypted information secure. It was also seen that it was easy to crack the DES and obtain access to sensitive information. The Advanced Encryption Standard was developed to improve upon the DES, and it took about 36 years to crack. The Advanced Encryption algorithm is used by virtual private systems, Wi-Fi, OS systems, mobile application, password managers, and etc. It is used throughout the world to protect passwords, messages, and credentials. Advantages of this encryption include that it is the most common security protocol used in a wide array of applications for commercial and open source solutions across the globe. It is very difficult to hack an Advanced Encryption Standard algorithm, so it can be considered a very safe protocol to use within the organization. Lastly, the RSA. This is an algorithm. It's a standard crypto system which is used to maintain the security system, security services that have the ability to enable a public key encryption to secure sensitive data. Its ability to enable the public key encryption is particularly used when being sent over an insecure network such as the internet. The RSA was first described in 1977 by two scientists from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Public key cryptography, or also referred to as asymmetric cryptography, uses two types of keys, public and private. The difference between the two is that the private key must be disclosed, while the public can be shared with everyone. Both a public and private can encrypt a message that has data. The opposite key from the one that's encrypted from the message will be used to decrypt it, which is why RSA is most widely an asymmetric algorithm. This type of algorithm will ensure that the organization or individual who is sending encrypted data has integrity, confidentiality, and proper data storage of their message. This algorithm stems its security from large integers that are a byproduct of two prime numbers. Most encryptions derive their security from multiplication, which is much more difficult to determine the prime numbers from the total using mathematical factoring methods. The private and public key creation for the RSA algorithm make it very complex, as it uses two large prime numbers and P and Q algorithm. And these are the references I used. Thank you.
Wow, that was awesome. Thank you. Anybody have any quick questions for her? Okay, great job, great job. Okay, who wants to go next?
I can go next.
Awesome, thank you. Love volunteers, thank you for that.
Okay.
Does Michael have a question?
No, sorry, I was meaning to clap.
Okay.
Okay, are you able to see the screen saying firewalls?
Yes.
Okay, great. My presentation's over firewalls, just a general overview and what they are, and I'll give you a table of contents here. I'll go over what is a firewall, the importance of them, how firewalls work, some uses of the firewall, best practices in configuring, different kinds of firewalls that exist, vulnerabilities, and just a couple links to some message boards or articles about firewalls in the news. So a firewall is a network security device that prevents unauthorized access to a network. It inspects incoming and outgoing traffic using a set of security rules to identify and block threats. Firewall can be physical hardware, digital software, software as a service, or a virtual private cloud. And they are used in both personal and enterprise settings. And many devices like Macs, Windows, and Linux computers come with built-in firewalls. Why are firewalls important? Firewalls serve as the first line of defense against external threats, such as hackers and malware attacks. In particular, firewalls combined with an IPS or an intrusion prevention system are crucial in preventing malware and certain application layer attacks. Firewalls did emerge first in the early days of the internet when networks needed new security methods that could handle increasing complexity. They've since become the foundation of network security in the client-server model, which is the central architecture of modern computing. Firewalls play an important role in preventing cyber attacks, protecting sensitive data, and maintaining the privacy and security of computer systems and networks. So how does a firewall work? Again, it's widely considered an essential component of network security. And a firewall establishes a border or a block between an external network and the network that it guards. It's inserted in line across a network connection, and it inspects all packets entering and leaving the guarded network. And as it inspects, it does use a set of pre-configured rules to distinguish between benign traffic and malicious traffic or packets. Rule sets can be based on a lot of different things that are indicated by the packet data, the source, destination, content, etc. And these characteristics can be represented differently at different levels of a network. And as a packet travels through the network, it can be reformatted or is reformatted several times to tell the protocol where to send it. And different types of firewalls exist to read packets at those different levels. So different uses for a firewall. Again, they're used in both corporate and consumer settings and just personal settings. They're incorporated into a security information and event management strategy aside other cybersecurity devices. Firewalls are used alongside different antivirus applications. Personal firewalls, unlike corporate ones, are usually a single product as opposed to having multiple products involved. And they can be used, they can again be a software or a device with firewalls that are actually embedded in the software or the device itself. Some different use cases for firewalls is as threat defense, logging and audit functions, traffic filtering, controlling and blocking access, securing remote access. Some best practices for firewalls or use of firewalls. Block all traffic by default and only permit specific traffic that's allowed. Follow the principle of least privilege and grant users only the minimal level of access that's required to complete their duties. Perform regular security audits to check for any vulnerabilities. Administer firewall change control to manage and track changes to firewall rules. Keep the firewall software current and updated to ensure that it can detect and block any new threats, so patching is necessary. Optimize firewall rules to reduce unnecessary processing and boost firewall performance. There are many different types of firewalls, and they're characterized by the way that they filter the data or by the system that they are protecting. And when they are categorized by what they protect, the two types are network-based and host-based. Network-based firewalls guard the entire network and are often hardware. And a host-based firewall guards individual devices, the hosts, and are often software. There are many different types of filter methods for firewalls. First being packet filtering firewalls. They examine data packets in isolation and don't know the packet's context. Stateful inspection firewalls. Those examine network traffic to determine whether one packet is related to another packet. Then security level gateway firewalls. They provide security by monitoring TCP handshaking between packets from trusted clients or servers to untrusted hosts and back and forth or vice versa. Proxy firewalls or the application level gateways, they inspect packets at the application layer of the OSI reference model. Next generation firewalls use a multi-layered approach to integrate enterprise firewall capabilities and with an IPS and application control. Threat-focused NGFWs, so threat-focused next generation firewalls, they combine the traditional firewall technology with enhanced functionality to thwart modern threats, and that includes including the application layer and advanced malware attacks. And then virtual firewalls, which are also called those cloud firewalls, protect traffic filtering and monitoring for virtual machines in a virtual environment. And then also with the cloud native firewalls, they provide automated scaling features that enable networking and security operations teams to run at quicker speeds. Some firewall vulnerabilities. A lot of the less advanced firewalls are vulnerable to higher level attacks. That's why the NGFWs or the new generation were introduced to address those kinds of vulnerabilities. They're also subject or vulnerable to insider attacks as well, DDoS attacks as well, malware, and patching and configuration. Just meaning a poorly configured firewall can be detrimental to a network. And then firewalls in the news, if you do get a copy of this or wanted to search for a copy of this presentation or take down a screenshot of these links, these are just good areas to find recent news about firewalls and the different vendors that exist and what's going on with their companies. And reference, and that is all.
Nice job. That was really detailed. Good job.
Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions? You guys are awfully quiet tonight. Okay, who's up next?
I can go next. Oh, sorry.
All right. Whoever wants to jump in.
Okay, I will go next, and I'll go ahead and share my screen.
Okay, thank you.
Can everyone see my screen okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so today I will be talking about social engineering attacks. What are social engineering attacks? Social engineering attacks are used to describe malicious activities that are carried out and accomplished through human interactions. Social engineering attacks use psychological manipulations to trick individuals, such as users and employees, into revealing sensitive information that is utilized by cybercriminals to gather entry into the organization's network. Social engineering attacks seek potential points of entry through weak security protocols to gain the victim's trust and allow the victim to reveal sensitive information to obtain access to credible resources within the organization. For example, a hacker might use social engineering to trick an employee into giving them access to a company's computer system. This can lead to data breaches and other security problems. Some common types of social engineering attacks include phishing, tabnabbing attack method, webjacking attack method, and HTA attack method. Phishing. Phishing is one of the most common types of social engineering attacks that occurs when the malicious attacker uses a form of communications, such as emails, to obtain background information or sensitive information into the network. Phishing is like when someone tries to trick you into giving them important information. It's usually done through email or a fake website that looks real. The attacker will often ask you or an employee to click on a link or enter in personal information, like a password or credit card information. If you fall for it, the attacker can then use the personal information to steal your money or identity, or to enter in within an organization's network. Phishing is bad for organizations because it can lead to data breaches and other security problems. Phishing is a type of social engineering attack that can be very damaging to an organization, as it could lead to lost revenue, legal problem, and damage to the organization's reputation. Tab-nabbing attack method. The tab-nabbing attack method is a social engineering technique that manipulates inactive web pages through phishing. The tab-nabbing attack occurs when a user clicks away from an open tab and a malicious hacker redirects the site to an illegitimate link, hoping that the employee or the user gives over login details and other sensitive information, making users believe that they opened the site themselves. A malicious attacker compromises the network and tricks the user into inputting sensitive information, making the user believe that the site is a legitimate site. Tab-nabbing occurs when a hacker replaces a browser tab with a spoof website that collects sensitive information from the user. The scope of this attack can penetrate the network of an organization and can cause malicious attackers to penetrate application, accounts, networks, and other assets that hold confidential information. Tab-nabbing can be mediated or prevented by well-crafted security policies and training set aside for employees of an organization. Security trainings enforced within the organization can help employees determine when such an attack occurs. Staff and employees can prevent these types of attacks by being aware and educated against tab-nabbing techniques. For example, some methods that can be used to help prevent tab-nabbing attacks can include taking a closer look at the page to see if there is an unusual layout or if there are spelling mistakes within the link. Users can also determine if such an attack occurs if the address bar is changed or seems inaccurate. Looking at the URL can help determine if something has been changed to the original browser. It can also help to have as few tabs open as possible to ensure that there has been no changes or phishing sites as the user changes between tabs. Webjacking attack method. The webjacking attack method is a social engineering attack where an attacker redirects a user's browser from a trusted domain to an illegitimate domain without the user's permission and obtains the user's sensitive information. The malicious attacker impersonates and controls an illegitimate domain, and the user is tricked into inputting sensitive information, such as login credential, credit card numbers, etc., which can lead to a phishing attack induced by the attacker. The scope of webjacking attack can aggressively penetrate the organization's network, accounts, credentials, and other information to obtain confidential information into the organization's infrastructure. Confidential information regarding the organization can be exposed and can lead to losses in customer confidence, reputation, market share, and finance for the business organization. Mitigation and prevention strategies include security training against phishing attacks for all employees. Mandatory security training can also be enforced for the staff to help spread awareness and gain education against social engineering attacks, such as the webjacking attack method. Trainings can help spread awareness and can help prevent these attacks from occurring within the organization. For example, the training can help employees become aware to check the address and URL to determine whether domain site is legitimate or illegitimate. This can also help employees remember not to input any type of sensitive information or data into a link that can be sent into the organization email box. HTA attack method. The HTA attack method is a type of attack in which a simple HTML application can provide full access to a hacker remotely. The HTA attack usually has a file extension of HTA in which the remote hacker can generate a malicious application for the Windows operating system using different types of web technologies. The HTA attack method does allow the remote hacker to clone a site and perform a PowerShell injection through the Windows system through a different browser. The HTA attack are primarily used in an organization or a company, such as an email phishing attack, that are sent through as attachments. Most companies have these email appliances either flagged or dropped that may contain HTA attachments. However, there are some scenarios where employees of organizations will have access to these HTA attachments, which can cause remote attackers a way into the system, which is done when the HTA files have been used by web attackers and remote droppers. There are a couple ways where an HTA attack can be prevented and can block remote hackers from doing a malware drop or code execution. Some steps organizations can take to enable protection against this attack is to ensure that employee files are kept under protection, utilizing proper security measures. Another way to prevent this is to keep a lookout for any attachments or emails that are not a part of the organization email addresses and only open files within a safe environment. And these are my references, and that was it. Thank you so much.
All right. Great job. Great job. Any questions for her? Okay. Who's up?
I can go next.
Oh, gotcha.
Great information.
Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Yep.
Okay, so today I'm going to be talking about digital kidnapping and the dangers of oversharing. Every day we share our loved ones online and don't think twice about it. But one thing many don't realize in this new age is the rise in digital kidnapping. This happens on a grand scale, and many don't realize it's happening until it's been happening for years. Not only that, but many don't understand the amount of information they are giving away with a single picture. What is digital kidnapping? It's much like catfishing. Someone takes your photos and says that they're theirs, but not only do they say that your child is theirs, people can also pull information from your post to gather information for social engineering. Let's look at a post that every proud parent makes, the birth of their baby or the first day of school. With this, you're giving someone the full name of your child, date of birth, location of birth, and possibly more. You're also giving them details about the school that they're going to, listing their teacher, their grade, and their school. Another problem that exists is your photos being stolen and posted to another account meant for people who seek out photos of children. Disturbing comments and only photos of young children show that these are not well-meaning accounts, and they all have hashtags that help lead back to these accounts. As someone who has been in a brand repping group that helped promote small businesses when my daughter was young, it was very common for someone in the group to ask for help in reporting an account due to someone stealing their child's image and posting it to their own account where grown people would make inappropriate comments on it. In a news story in Today News in 2018, they brought a cybersecurity expert, Jess Wenenberg, and had her look over Michelle and Reese's social media accounts. From these, she was able to learn the children's names, their schools, the names of their teachers, the playground they would like to go to, how often they went to this playground, the path they walked to school, and more. These can pose a threat for physical kidnapping, among other issues. Last month, a man was found to be stealing and using a little girl's photos for 8 years. Where did I? Sorry, I looked at the screen and I lost my spot. Hold on. The most shocking thing, this is not illegal. The reason he's facing charges is for fraud he committed using the girl's photos to say he was a struggling single dad and needed the money, among other weapons charges. Another lady this year had someone stealing her ultrasound photos and pretending that they were hers so she could try and get her boyfriend back. The dangers of the internet are easy to forget, but according to techjury.net, 500,000 predators a day are using social media to target children, whether to steal their photos for their own accounts, trying to private message them, or stealing their information, they are on the hunt. That cute photo of your child learning to use the toilet or licking ice cream, it might end up on a porn site or Instagram account tailored to pedophiles. Our children's digital footprint is our responsibility. Giving out too much information could lead to endangering them, not only their digital well-being, but even the possibility of identity theft. One out of every 50 children, this is a new statistic, this image that's up on the screen is from a few years ago, will have their identity stolen. So that's about 1.25 million children a year. And with China's social credit score, there have been talks about making this a national standard. This could be something that could affect future job opportunities and other aspects of your children's future. The biggest downfall in technology and social media is the lack of laws that surround some of these issues. Digital kidnapping is not illegal. It is considered a gray area of the law. Well, you can take action if someone pretends to be you. There is nothing you can do if they pretend to be, have their child be their child. The most you can do if someone takes your photos is and posts them as their own is complain to the social media outlet. And many times, even with those photos will not be taken down. This means that we are solely responsible for their safety. So what can we do? The steps to take are to blur out information when sharing pictures, such as the school name, have your profile set to personal, and a good rule of thumb is whenever you need to change your clocks, you should also go through your friends and clean your clean house. If you need a profile for work that is public, then create a separate account. This will keep your personal and your private information separate. This is also a good rule of thumb to save any photos of a child bathing or learning to go potty for a physical photo album and not share them online. Make sure that your camera doesn't record your location due to EXIF information and photos being extracted. As of late, Facebook and Instagram now do scrub uploaded photos to remove this information because they were having problems with people taking this information and using it to find out people's locations, but it's still a good rule of thumb to follow. There aren't a lot of laws that are in place to keep up with this digital kidnapping, so it's our responsibility to take those steps. And if anyone has any questions, and I have a very long list of resources.
Great job. Margie, yeah. You want to take over? Go ahead.
I was going to say great job and good points that you make, because that's something that my sister and I have been back and forth about. Every time we go to visit somewhere, I meet her in Orlando or she comes up here to Tallahassee and we usually go somewhere else, she takes all the pictures now and she gets mad at me because I won't take the pictures. But my kids are older and I don't have to worry as much. But it's not that I worry so much that somebody's going to use their images or take their images, but I don't put them often on there, you know, on Facebook or anything. We use it basically for the family because we have family in Europe, so we want them to see the kids as they grow up. But, you know, I've told her we have to get a little bit more aware of what we're doing and all the pictures that we're putting up.
Yeah. Most cases of identity theft happen to people, like, you already know the person who steals your identity.
Yeah.
And you normally, especially with children, you won't find out that that has happened until they're older. I actually, you can call, is it Experian? I can't remember. But you can call them and have them freeze your children's credit, which I don't know why that doesn't come standard. I did it just because my ex actually stole my identity, and I wanted to make sure he never got a hold of my children's information.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, I just don't want, I think a lot of it has to come down to, especially their credit, it comes down to a parent taking that child's social security number and starting their credit. And, you know, you hate to have that happen to that child. It's already hard enough for us to fix our credit, you know, to have our kids do it.
Right.
Yeah. That was excellent. Good point. Well, because I wasn't here, I'm not sure who goes next.
I believe.
I didn't have the agenda, Martin.
No problem. We have John.
Yep. Give me one.
Is that our last one?
Think so. Okay. Okay. Can everyone see the presentation?
Yes.
Okay. You don't see the notes on the side, do you?
No, I see that your full slide.
All right, nice. Okay. Hello and welcome to my PowerPoint presentation on how to create a great PowerPoint. Let's dive right in. Okay. All right, up first, we'll be covering some essentials for planning your presentation. Okay, the first step I would advise is to form a framework of the topics that you feel will benefit your PowerPoint prior to beginning it. This has the benefit of focusing on your vision for the presentation and forming a foundation without the stress of trying to work as you go. The second step in planning your presentation is to find supporting evidence for your material. For instance, recently, working on these slides and researching content for the slides deck has led me to find that there are formulas for creating effective PowerPoint slides. Okay, next slide. The third step is to ensure that you do not overwhelm yourself. Rome was not built in a day, and neither will your presentation if you do not give ample opportunity for your creativity to come to fruition over a reasonable period. The fourth step is to ensure that you are delivering a slide deck of high quality rather than high quantity. Further on in this presentation, we will touch on specific ways that you can learn to have your slides embody this principle. For now, please keep in mind the fact that you may have come across other slide decks that have impressed you or were presented in a way that left an effect on you. Try to foster a desire to learn of their styles and the ways they improve the quality of their slides and apply it to your own. Okay, the fifth and sixth steps to planning your presentation include learning that less is more and that acquiring feedback fosters great and powerful slides. Simplicity should be considered paramount in your slides, allowing your audience to absorb your messages without becoming overwhelmed by an excess of presented material. Acquiring feedback allows you to increase the quality of your slides and lets you get an outside perspective on your slide whilst working on them so you can tailor them to their best possible quality. These six steps can assist you in planning your PowerPoint presentation by giving you a basis of info to work off of before, during, and after diving into making your slide deck. Clean and Concise focuses on the four key points one should consider when creating any slide in your deck. The first of these points is compressing your message. This can be in the form of bulleted points or accentuating a message with images present like in this slide. Secondly, using the notes menu present at the bottom of PowerPoint is great as it allows you to record any notes that one would take for the presentation, like a set of cards or a script. The versatility of this text field was never emphasized to me, but I feel it is important for others to learn about their benefit. Third is a bit difficult, but can be implemented with some creativity. Raise your hand if you've been bored with someone's PowerPoint slide at any point in your life. Okay, all right. If you've raised your hand, then my engagement techniques are working. But you are not restricted to just this. You can definitely capture your audience's attention with other forms of interaction. Finally, using the tools available to you in PowerPoint may seem like a no-brainer, but there is much that is regularly ignored that could be leveraged in your favor. Has anyone here been stuck with grabbing a text box in PowerPoint and trying to make it just right on a slide? I've also been there. It's kind of a pain. All right. I've done this many times over and learned whilst working on these presentations that you can align text with other objects on screen with the shape format tab. And my mind was blown. There's also a selection pane that allows you to select any object on screen without having to move other things out of the way. And it helps tremendously in making it both faster and easier to edit later on. Okay, next slide. Let's see if my animation will play. Yep. So if you have probably noticed, one of the ongoing themes of this PowerPoint is the emphasis on using visuals to convey information. This is by design, and most great PowerPoints reel us in with the power of visual elements and their relevancy to the topics at hand. Other aspects of great PowerPoints include labeling of all figures and tables to give everyone watching an idea of what they're looking at without having to immediately tell them, until you build to it promptly within your presentation. Creativity should not be shunned when creating a slide deck, and one of the easiest ways to do this is with animation, transitions, and style choices. Taking inspiration from other slides and relevant ideas can help you improve your slides tremendously alongside creativity. Finally, using a consistent and/or appealing, easy to understand theme lets you keep an audience's attention without bringing about their slumber. Unique and beautiful slides can also have this effect of staying in others' minds for longer periods. Okay, now for something completely different. Here we have an egregious example of what is generally considered a horrible slide. It comes complete with stretched images, text that is far too small and clashes with whatever excuse of a theme this is, icons and shapes that have no place here whatsoever, and a massive header. Although I am aware that no one present in today's masterclass would ever present such a horror to their place of employment, it is important to have an example on the most negative portion of the spectrum and strive to never present something like this to another unless you're looking to get a laugh out of them. Okay. All right. Headers and animation are a very important part of PowerPoint, and with a bit of skill can be leveraged to make your presentations look like $1 million for minimal effort and some YouTube searches. Here we can see that I have used the animation tab wizardry to form a modern theme slide. Although I would like to be magical, this slide is merely the work of two arc shapes that have a gradient color grouped together, copy-pasted, and then given the spin animation, with arcs of differing sizes. Animated and header slides like these can pique the interest of your audience and allow you to utilize this time to deliver your message to be compounded in the minds of your viewers by the quality and unique visage of your slide. And that is my presentation. I would be happy to see, hear or see your feedback on my presentation, whether that be either through the channel, direct message. Thank you very much for your time. And yeah.
Another great job.
Thank you.
Are you telling me that within an hour we got it done with everybody?
Yeah.
Wow. Great job, guys. You kept it all at 15 minutes or less, so.
Yeah.
And still got that good information in there. That's nice. Well, thanks, everybody. Hope you enjoyed Masterclass this evening. And thank you for Marcia for covering me at the beginning. You guys did a great job, and congratulations for finishing one of your masterclass, depending on how many you had to do. And you all did a great job. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of the evening.
You as well.
Good night. Great job, everyone.
Have a good night.
Yeah. Have a good night.